This is No Direction's PaizoCon 2018 seminar coverage. PaizoCon 2018 seminar coverage was made possible thanks to the support of the Roll for Combat podcast, as well as the dedication of our team of volunteers. Due to possibly questionable language, this panel is rated Sorry, Ryan.
Sorry, Ryan.
Sorry, Ryan.
Planets panel, and it seems like an introductions is a good way to start a panel. So I'm Liz Liddell. I'm an editor at Paizo. I edit for Starfinder, among other things, and I have designed one planet and written about a couple of others, and I guess I'm in charge of the panel because they let me do that.
Yep.
My name's Chris Sims. I'm a developer for Starfinder, and I think I designed my first planet when I was about 9.
I'm Owen Casey Stevens. I'm the Starfinder design lead. Like Chris, I was designing planets well before anyone was paying me to design planets. But professionally, I did a lot of work for the Star Wars role-playing game, so I did a lot of planet design then, and then obviously picked it up again for Starfinder.
I don't know why they let me sit on this panel.
We're developers. You're an editor.
That's
all
right.
You had to do was erase someone's name and write your own in. We wouldn't have noticed.
That's actually pretty much exactly
what
happened.
That's very close to what happened, yes.
So, designing planets, what are some things that go into designing planets? You want to talk about, like, what this process looks like and sort of, like, what things you think about, what your starting points are, what your goals are?
Sure. You want to go first, Chris, or shall I?
I'll go first.
Okay, go.
So, when I design a planet, it depends on what its use is going to be. Some planets are adventure sites, and some planets are worlds that are completely inhabited. And other planets are scenery, I guess, or background material, like a station's orbiting a planet. So it depends on what its value is to the story, I guess. Its narrative value. That's my starting point.
Probably because I'm the rules design lead, the very first thing I just determine is how big is it going to be and how heavy is its gravity and what is its atmosphere. Because that requires some math, we actually use the real-world formula to determine mass, diameter, gravity. And I don't want to make a narrative decision that requires me to end up saying, oh, but there's a giant core of anti-gravity metal in the center of the planet, because I've already done other things and they don't work. So I set those statistical things, and once I've determined mass, diameter, gravity, that will generally dictate what my options are for how dense the atmosphere is, although we have a little more wiggle room with that. Once I have those, that usually has led me to have some sort of conceptual hook for the planet. Again, I got my professional start for designing planets in Star Wars, and Star Wars planets are incredibly unrealistic because pretty much all Star Wars planets have one biome. This planet is a city. This planet is frozen. This planet is a desert. There's nothing wrong with occasionally having a one biome planet, but it's a trope that has been beaten to death by Star Wars and everything that wanted to seem like Star Wars. So if I have a hook, I try and avoid making it a biome hook. I prefer my hooks to be things like, here's a planet with light gravity and a two-hour day. So you get a dawn every 2 hours, and the day is constantly... That right there gives me an idea what adventure here will be. Or here's a planet that's covered in large primordial creatures, and then I can just pick which ones go in each biome. But I want a hook, a thing that makes this interesting. Frequently what that hook is going to be based, as Chris said, on what do I need this planet for.
See, I don't care about the science. I care about the story. And if the science doesn't work out, I can say, magic.
We did have to do this.
And I want to save hand-waving magic for planets where I want it to be important that magic has had that impact.
Yeah.
Right? If we have a planet, hey, here's a planet where technology doesn't work well and magic runs rampant, then I might specifically ditch the formula and do something like that. Water flows up. Night happens twice, but dawn only once. There's anything you can do if you want to.
Metal is made out of giant crystals, not metal and magma.
The native species can use their hair to telepathically communicate with giant animals, and they're giant floating pieces of rock, which for some reason don't drift off into space, just in case anyone saw Avatar.
but they don't drift off into space because magic, right?
Yeah, well, apparently.
Also, they breed with their hair, so you know that's kind of weird when they talk to the animals.
I thought you were talking about Lashuntas.
Yeah, you think it's weird, but in their culture, that's perfectly natural.
What are some sort of pitfalls that you've seen or that you've like wandered into or like fallen face first into that that have come up while designing planets?
I'll go and take that one first.
Beyond the ones I've already mentioned, planets are big. When you look like at Galarian, we have spent 11 or 12 years and thousands of pages starting to detail mostly one part of two continents and one small section of ocean around one important city, and we're nowhere near done. So when you are designing a planet, one of the reasons we frequently get into the one biome planet, which I try to avoid, is that it's much easier to say Hoth 2 is covered in ice, and then I don't have to describe anything else. This is also why frequently there is one noteworthy culture, one noteworthy continent. That's boring, especially if it happens too much. So it's a pitfall to try to simplify things too much. I think it is better, even if you don't have a lot of room, to say, hey, there are six major continents, there are 12 major cultures, of which the largest and most important is, and then I say what it is. That means that we haven't outlined the rest, but first of all, GMs can do that with whatever they come up with. I mean, if you have some favorite science fiction thing, you're like, okay, there are going to be Vulcan Batleth-wielding Jedi over there. You can do that, that's fine. But also, that once we do those name drops, and there's a lot of that in the core rulebook, we're like, there's this one species. Working on Alien Archive 2, we had some races we'd name drop, and Chris took several of those, and he was like, all right, we've said four things about this, most of them three words long. What cool thing can I do that makes that true, but is also much more interesting than that is? He did that with several things. I'm specifically thinking of your...
The Corlu?
Yes. The name of which I was not coming up with. Which were really cool. So
little guys with lithic shells and made kind of out of Earth element.
So I think it is a mistake to try to describe everything. You don't have room. And I think it's a mistake to say there only exists what I am saying here. I think it's fine if you want to say, you know, we had like 90 sentient species on Galarian. If you're doing a science fantasy game, I think it's fine to say, hey, there are four major sentient species. One of them controls this area mostly, and here it is.
I think it's a pitfall is to have no hook. And because for a game, everything has to be useful for the game. Even for fiction, it has to be useful for a story. And I also think that in some ways, saying too much is a problem. Like, limiting it too much so it's less useful for the game in general. And what I mean is, like, you define everything so a GM doesn't have freedom to slot it in where it might go in his or her campaign.
One of the things I see a lot on the boards are people saying, I don't understand why they don't detail what all the gun control laws are for all the countries and all the Pact Worlds and the Vescarium. And, well, game mechanically, we've covered what weapons you can pick up by saying you can only buy things up to your level plus two. That's the level at which you can get the necessary licensing or bribes or reputation to pick them up. We don't want to define what all the gun laws are because, first of all, gun laws are complicated. And secondly, that would be a big, long, boring list of you can't tell this story on this world, you can't tell this story on this world. That's the sort of thing we only want to define when it's important, and otherwise let the GMs define it.
And in addition, it's redundant because it's already built into that level system.
And the only question left is, hey, if I took my level plus three plasma rifle off a dead guy, am I going to get in trouble if I pull that out and shoot it? And we can just leave that in the GM's hands. He can decide what's legal. We don't have to define absolutely everything.
If you shoot it in the middle of Kuvakar on Verses, you might get in trouble.
But on Akaton, you're probably fine.
Yeah.
And on Octurn, you're really fine.
Until the land reacts to you hitting it.
Well, you're on Octurn. What do you think? what are you expecting?
On Octurn, whether or not your plasma rifle is illegal is not at the top of your list of concerns.
And on a apostate, then someone's probably going to be like, that's what you're using? Let me sell you a bit.
Well, or, hey, where'd you get that? Are there more?
Are there more?
Can I have it?
Are we supposed to be designing a planet, or are we just talking about designing?
This is just talking about designing a planet. We can go to Q&A if you want to. It's okay. Whatever you want to do.
Oh, I'm in charge. I'm really in charge. Let's take some questions, and then if they spark things, we'll talk more. But what do people want to know about planets?
I guess one personal question. You said you worked on Star Wars. Which Star Wars system?
All of the D20 Star Wars systems.
Oh, wow.
I was hired by Wizards of the Coast in 2000. I was one of the three people on the Star Wars team for the core rulebook. I wrote the original Starships of the Galaxy. Mm-hmm. I worked on Tempest Feud. And I worked on that adventure with Jeff Grubb, and then Jeff was later contracted by Lucasfilm to turn that into an actual novel, which is the only novel I've ever gotten a thank you from the author for helping to come up with the game it is based on. I then worked on the revised core rulebook and most of the things that came after that, and then with Rodney Thompson, I was one of the two authors of the Saga System core rulebook.
Awesome.
Thanks for asking. I love saying that.
Question in the back.
That's a great question. I think that falls directly into what Chris was saying. When you're designing a planet, it's often about what do I need this for? So if I have a cool idea for an alien, if I'm like, I want an alien that's like 2 feet tall because it's being crushed by heavy gravity, but because it falls so fast, its reflexes are great, and it can breathe poison, I might well have a cool idea for an alien. And then once I've written that, I go, okay, what planet can I put this on? And if we already have one, I might just say it goes there. But if not, I might design a world around the inhabitants. You can also design it around an adventure, right? Like if you're doing, I'm doing an adventure and I want people to actually have to worry about the radiation rules, and spacesuits in our game protects you against all forms of light radiation if you have the protections on, then I might say, well, what's a planet that has high levels of radiation, so it's dangerous, that player characters will still go to for some reason? And then you're designing a planet that's like, okay, it's highly radioactive, but a lot of that stuff is valuable. So there are mines, and people are protected to guard them, and there are, you know, uranium barons and cargo shipments of plutonium which get stolen. So yeah, frequently I think you find yourself saying, I've got all of these elements, be that an adventure or a race, or even like, you know, we want to have an alien artifact, and then you design the world from that.
Yeah, that's funny. It I designed a Corlu first to take that example, and I knew that I wanted them to be like, have kind of lava in their belly, and to have a stone shell, and to have flexible like material, but for their body. But I designed the world to fit what they apparently evolved as. So I a lot of times start with the people that live on the planet.
That was the experience I had with the planet I designed. It was sort of a like. Sent a whole bunch of us to go design planets all at once, and I was like, okay, well, like, what hasn't really been done yet? And it's space, so what's wacky? And so we're like, ooze people. How do you make an ooze person? What kind of world would spawn intelligent ooze people? And so that sort of kicked off the, like, okay, well, like, if you're amorphous, then you're obviously going to be resistant to, like, a lot of things like changing gravity. And so how do you make a world with changing gravity? Well, you have, like, a weird complex, like, binary planet system going around a binary star system, so the gravity's, like, really weird. You get gravity storms.
And not just ooze people. That has ooze, mobile ooze cities.
Mobile ooze cities, yeah. So it's, you know, you've got this whole society of where the only form of life is this amorphous stuff that can put up with this incredible stress that the planet is dealing with. Oh, and liquid core, so it's sort of sloshy. It makes it even worse.
It's not official, but since I developed that world, I started thinking of them as Ooziarchies. But it is a really cool idea, right? Because she went with, here's this invite, I want this to have been the dominant evolved life form. What the heck would cause that to happen? And then she created a fascinating world that has the fascinating creature, and so it's sort of got its own story hook built in, right? I mean, this is a species of oozes. If you want the world's best Dr. Scholl's gel shock inserts, this is the planet you go to. So
and
that's all.
Fun too.
Yes. And anything can be an inspiration. For one of the worlds I wrote up, I was looking at Solarian weapon crystals, which are just an item in our game. And a lot of them are tied to fundamental magical or magical forces. Scientific or magical forces. And I thought it'd be really interesting if there was something called Black Emerald, which was a crystal that had a natural connection to the elemental plane of shadow. So that you would make certain dark instead of glowing like most crystals. Here's a black one that sucks light into it.
You could put your black hole moat.
Right. And then I created a world that is so far from its sun that its sun is just a slightly brighter star. And it's only warm because it has a radioactive core that is devolving. And it's horrible and cold, and it has shadows so dark that they actually connect to the plane of shadow. But it's the only place in the universe people have found this black emerald. So people are setting up mining colonies. And the other advantage to that was, because I did have a short section, this relates back to that you can't define anything, by connecting it to the Plane of Shadow, I said, there's no native life here, but things from the Plane of Shadow come through, and they can take the Shadow Simple Template and apply it to any other creature that is found anywhere in the galaxy, and a shadow version of it dwells here. So in 500 worlds, I was able to take a planet and say, oh, you can run into anything, any CR, any kind of critter, it'll just be a shadow critter. So the GM has huge flexibility in what he does with that world, but that inspiration all came from an item rather than even a creature or a plot.
Yeah, how do you avoid, you talked a little bit about the stereotype of this is the desert planet, mm-hmm. and this is the forest planet. How do you avoid creating, when you have such a big galaxy and you're creating planets to fill it with, how do you avoid repetition? Like, how do you make sure you're keeping your inspiration points fresh?
I just design for what I need. I don't try to design. It's the same thing as designing a campaign world for a fantasy game. You design what you need first and expand from there instead of trying to do everything up front.
I frequently take an exactly the opposite approach. And that's cool. I see why you do that. I am a fan of science fiction, especially pulp science fiction, going back to stuff written in the 20s and 30s and sometimes the 1800s. So I try to have sort of a finger touch knowledge of the most common tropes. And nowadays, TVTropes.com will help with that if I think maybe there's a trope and I can't come up with it. And so one of the things that happens is I've got ideas going through my head all the time, or I encounter ideas. And if I have one like, ooh, wouldn't it be cool if there was this planet connected to the elemental plane of shadow? I don't recall ever seeing that before. So those ideas become the ones that excite me the most. It just when I find something and it doesn't seem to match in. When I find something that does seem too similar, like if I am developing a world and the creative director and the writer have already decided this is going to be an ice planet. We've decided that that's where this adventure is going. Then you have to try and find a new spin on things. Okay, if it's an ice planet, what can I make different? Well, maybe instead of being an ice planet that is so cold people are always freezing to death, this is an ice planet, but it's 31 degrees, just practically the whole planet. All you need is a good jacket and some solid shoes and you're good. And there's a lot of melt-off and runoff, so you can have these really cold rivers, and that you've got glaciers and vast, very cold seas that are just 1 degree too warm. And then you can make it very, very different from a traditional ice planet where you'll freeze to death if you're out at night. I have a question right there.
I was just, because about the cold dark world with the Plane of Shadow connection.
Uh-huh.
You know, in general, do you tend to, when you're building worlds, go for more of a sci-fi approach, natural laws, and then graphic fantasy stuff on top? Or how often do you integrate the fantastic stuff, you know, into the core concept of the planet, even before you add the creatures and people? Like, you know, with your ice world, I was just thinking, well, how about something like, you know, an outer system icy rock ball, like all the moons of the gas giants? But its core is a gateway to the elemental plate of fire, so instead of being a solid ice ball, it's more like space Iceland.
So first of all, that's another thing to be very cool, right? So Starfinder in particular, we very much want to be a science fantasy setting, right? We have mystics and technomancers and there are gods, and it's the same cosmology as Pathfinder. So sometimes the answer is, what fits the purpose of this, like Chris was talking, right? If we're telling a story, what is that story and how much magic is in that? I always want to keep in mind both the scientific and the fantastical, and I decide on a case-by-case basis how much I combine. But, and even our original world, Galarian, was known as the Cage because the planet itself was the prison for Rovagug, the creature that could destroy the universe. So even our original world, which is very clearly a fantasy Earth pastiche, also serves a mystic purpose. So I think we are very, very likely to at least have lines on things that could relate to the fantastic. We're talking about Octurn earlier, right? There's Karsai the King and Elder Cthulian beings having a war with the Dominion of the Black out there. That's nothing but a big pulsing sack of Elder evil that happens to look like a planet right now. It's way on the, not only is science not a concern, it may not be relevant end of things.
Science need not apply.
Right. Whereas Octurn is pretty clearly a Mars-like ball of rock that is mostly a desert because the water has escaped and it's got a low atmosphere. And while there probably aren't...
Or Akaton.
Yeah, sorry, Akaton. I misspoke. And it's largely itself as a planet scientific, but then you can start asking yourself, what does it have that's different, right? Is there a dragon graveyard, or is there a whole bunch of petrified aboleth beneath one of its sandy seas that used to live in great swamp oceans? Whatever. So you can take come at it from either way. If I'm doing some other game system like Star Wars, then you're looking at other elements, and you sort of see what does the universe call for as far as a ratio goes.
Yeah, and I almost always add fantasy elements just because it is science fantasy. So I look for opportunities to add fantasy elements or make stuff that couldn't possibly exist in science. Not necessarily a giant maggot over evil, but, you know.
That was one extreme.
Yeah, it's one extreme. You know, a giant fey planet that life comes from the inside out, you know, and everything that's growing on the surface is also all the way through it in caverns that are magical, and there's also a sun inside or whatever, you know, that type of thing. Like a magical Dyson sphere.
When I was running one of the first playtest adventures I ran, which was actually streamed with several podcast guys, they discovered that the planet they had gone to was not a planet. It was a single giant plant. And so they thought it was sort of a forest world, but it was in fact just billions of spores that grew and drew energy from our first world. So it didn't even need nutrients from outside. Normally these spores are, you know, the size of a house, but they grow as they age and they never stop. So this solar system had several of these enormous pulsing plants. And if you attacked them, the symbiotic creatures that lived on them would defend it. So if you land your spaceship, which is heavy and has rockets and does damage, just landing was seen as the local fauna as an attack on the ecosystem that protected them. That is obviously a scientifically implausible, very fantasy-based world. But the players, when they realized what was going on, were like, oh my god, we haven't even been thinking in terms of we could be standing on a creature.
You had mentioned TV tropes as a resource that you use to sort of check in and see if something's been done before.
Yep.
I know as an editor, when I'm sort of like reality checking things that come across my desk from time to time, I have a couple of resources that I use. What resources do you use... I guess this is coming from the place that, like, I am not a scientist, and wow, I don't think anyone in the office is an astrophysicist. So what are the resources you use to sort of reality check the things you're designing to maintain an air of plausibility when that's something you want to maintain?
The National Geographic desk reference.
While no one in the office is an astrophysicist, two of our employees are graduates of MIT. And both of them are very, very smart and very, very well informed. So, for example, in the core rule book, I was telling you there's a formula to make sure that your diameter and gravity and mass are all correct. Mark Seifter did all that math. We didn't do any of it. We told him, you say there is a formula. Will you please use it and make sure these numbers all end up accurate? And I think what would have been 2 or 3 days of work for any of us took him about an hour. So one of the things to know is who do I know, especially in the company, but also who will consult with me, who might know a lot of things. My mother was the president of the Oklahoma L5R Society and has been on the board of the International Space Development Conference. So I have family connections that know people at NASA that if I wanted, I can't interview them unless it's really important, but I can ask my mom, do you know anyone who would know where to look for this piece of information? Also, weirdly, while I never trust Wikipedia to be accurate, Wikipedia's articles do generally cite their primary sources, so it's a great compilation of other sources. So if I am wondering what are the current best theories on dark matter, I can go look at it, I can get a layman's read, and if I'm like, well, that sounds weird and I'm not sure if it's true, there's a little 14 here, all right, that goes to a peer-reviewed scientific paper, I can go, and I can't read the peer, I mean, I could, but I wouldn't understand it, but those things usually have a description of what they discovered at the, and you can read that one paragraph, and you're like, okay, this does in fact seem to be what's going on. When we were designing the core rulebook, in Pathfinder, the rules specifically say that space is cold, and you take cold damage. Mark Seifter noted that space is not cold. Space is devoid of temperature. And because there's no medium for heat to leave through any source other than radiation, you don't even get cold fast. And several people, I actually knew that because I'd run into some science fiction that covered it, but several people on the team were like, what do you mean space isn't cold, right? People go into space and they freeze. And he's like, well, first of all, no one's actually gone into space. We don't do that. You're thinking of some science fiction show and they got it wrong. And they're like, well, we could have space be cold, right? And like Chris said, we could have done what space is infused with the natural power of ice. We could have done that. We decided not to, so we actually did some research to figure out, is space cold? And if not, what is actually damaging it? Which is why if you go out into space in Starfinder, you end up taking bludgeoning damage, because a lot of what happens is the zero pressure means the pressure of your body is actually bruising you, pressing you outward, which we felt bludgeoning damage is as close as we got to that.
The thing is, you can also, I mean, starting at something like Wikipedia and not even going to a scientific article, but looking, well, just being inspired by the various things you find there and just using them as... And it doesn't have to be accurate because magic.
Yeah, she was asking what resources I used to check for verisimilitude, for accuracy. Chris is exactly right. If I'm trying to think of, I want on this planet for there to be a weird and interesting governmental system, then I don't have to check any references in Wikipedia. If I go to Wikipedia and I discover, oh, there are groups that have mandatory voting. What's the name of that? It's Sunday.
Mandatory,
I'm so tired.
Networks.
Democracy. Mandatory democracy, where it is illegal to not vote.
Yeah, I'm from one of those.
Yeah, they exist, but it wouldn't matter if they existed or not for the purposes of me deciding that's a quirk to put into a government. And then I can be inspired about go as far as I want, right? What if there's mandatory voting and there's no age minimum? So if you're under the age of 12, your parents must vote for you. Or what if there's mandatory voting and you've got about 10 minutes and everyone has a comm link? Bing! There's a new question. All right, I got to read this really fast, really fast. You know what? The guy I like online says I should vote yes. I'll vote yes. You could even have mandatory informed voting. There's a telepathic cap you put on when you go vote. And if you don't know about the question, you're penalized for not knowing how to vote. These are all things we can inspire. The core of whether or not there actually are such countries, and to be clear, there are, doesn't matter for that inspiration.
I want to know about the real-world society that has thinking caps that penalize you for trying to vote when you don't know what you're doing.
the thinking caps. Yeah, I was going to say, it's Australia.
We don't have the thinking caps yet.
Yeah, you know that, but she's not going to fly there and check me.
Question in the back.
Have you ever done anything inspired by some of the weirder real exoplanets, especially since a lot of them are not conventionally considered life-supporting, but the definition of life in a Pathfinder setting is a lot broader?
I'm not sure if it's by a specific exoplanet, but finding life to put on a planet that shouldn't have life is a great way to do something like that. I mean, that's kind of what our gas giants are anyway.
Yes, true.
You know, like, the Brethidens are improbable life forms. You know? Improbable life forms are lots of fun, so...
Yeah, well, I was thinking about, like, okay, so you got those, you know, those hot super Earths with the, you know, silica rain and stuff, and I thought, well, there's probably magmans who love that.
Magmans? Yep.
Yeah. I mean, one of the planets we describe in our setting is the sun, which has cities on it. And we announced last night that we were doing an AP called...
Dawn of Flame.
So you can pretty well depend that there's going to be some fire-based critters in that. So the hot exoplanets, for example, I have not specifically played with. The shadow planet I was talking about, the fact that it's only warm because it has a radioactive core, that idea came to me from having read about planets that seem to be warmer than we would expect based on how far they are from the solar system and what mechanisms, either radioactive or tectonic, could have caused that warmth. That's all theory, but that's good enough for us. And we have already had an article where we talk about an extrasolar planet, a planet that escaped its solar system and is drifting cold and lifeless through the void of space, based on us actually having made observations that we think are such things, that in this case is a naval base for the corpse fleet who are all undead. They don't care if their home planet is cold and lifeless, and in fact not being in a solar system where anyone else can find them is a good thing.
When you were talking earlier about how, you know, you check your math to make sure the density and all that's right,
mm-hmm.
Do you do that with orbits and, like, orbital tilt, size of orbit and shape of orbit and things like that?
No.
I do if it's interesting, but, you know.
So, the Pact World system is very much based on our solar system. It has, basically speaking, planets in the of the same size, same mass, in the same orbits, with the same length years, the same length days, the same orbital tilts. And we did that because we know of at least one solar system that does that, so we don't have to do the math. We have not detailed any other solar system as a system with that much detail. So if we say, hey, here's a solar system that has five planets and this one has life on it, and we tell you its day and its year, we then don't tell you about the days and the years of the rest of the planets because we assume they are whatever they have to be for this day and year to make sense. And that is just a case of it being more math than we want to tackle for what is, relatively speaking, not that important a question.
And everybody's on the same time frame anyway. They're on a standard year.
Yeah,
hour and a standard minute.
We carefully say that for game mechanical purposes, a minute's a day is a year, even if dawn goes up six times. So when and if we do the Vascarium, it is conceivable that we will ask Mark Seifter if he feels like doing all that math. I don't.
Because I saw a bunch of YouTube videos from a guy. He was just discussing different orbital paths and things like that. And how a donut planet is technically possible, it just might not last very long.
Yeah, it totally is, and we have discussed donut planets more than once. I don't think we've done one yet, but there are donut-shaped planets and trinary systems. And for that matter, we talked about doing a blue sun that had 56 planets in the inhabitable zone just because it's so freaking big. Which, again, mathematically would work. These are all things we've considered that are sort of in our index file of ideas that we haven't gone to yet.
And I also want to do a planet that has a weird elliptical orbit. So what would the life like that be? Life on that planet be like? Because it leaves, it's farther from, too far from the sun for life at one point, and then...
So triaxis, but more realistic?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or maybe not more realistic. Maybe that's an explanation for the Game of Thrones winter. I don't know.
Well, right, and for that matter, since we do have gods, right, we could perfectly well say, hey, here's a solar system. Say Renray controls this quarter of the solar system. We're not telling you why. It doesn't matter. She's in charge. And so when the planet is in that quarter of the solar system, it's warm and summer-like. This one is controlled by Zonkuthon, so once you enter it, the sun does not come up on the planet, period. It is twilight for 3 months. This quarter...
We thought Seattle winters were bad.
Yeah. And they are. So that is something we could do if we wanted to play with that sort of thing without having to worry about the math. Like Chris said, we've got magic. So anytime what we want to do is say, here's this fantastic magical thing, we can.
We also say weird things about things that are also science, the sun is not just star physics. It's also portals to the positive energy plane and portals to the plane of fire that combine to give this life-giving radiation, supposedly. It's that started in Pathfinder.
Right, so. Totally.
Question here, Evan.
Going back a little bit, with the weird look forward, maybe do some fun stuff with the hibernation of animals or pictures of their cycles like that.
Yeah, creatures that come out while it's farther away from the planet, and some go to sleep, and then reverses as
we can do a whole Riddick thing, maybe.
Yeah. It's black, yeah.
I was immediately thinking it might be interesting to have a planet, and all the species are basically phoenixes. So as it gets too close to the sun, they all burn up and die.
Oh, wow!
And then once the sun is out of that zone, they are all resurrected from their ashes for the next 4 months, and then they all burn up and die.
Yeah. Hachin, what you got?
I was just wondering... You mentioned Jeff Grubb, and I love Jeff Grubbian ridiculous crystal sphere physics.
Uh-huh.
And so I was wondering, what are some of your either guilty pleasure, physics star systems out there in the world of other properties, or likewise, what are any novels or materials that you feel have been really well done?
I absorb a lot of stuff, Jeff's stuff included. So I have read most of the encyclopedias of worlds for Star Wars, and that's a case where there's a lot of... Once you move past the movies and the animated series into all the novels, the comics, the things that were on the back of lunchboxes that were at the time considered canon, the old EU...
The Christmas special?
No. There is literally one thing that was officially declared not at any level of canon, and it was the Christmas special. In the old days, they used to literally have levels of canon. There was A canon, B canon, C canon, and then the Christmas special.
People wonder why they wiped the EU and started over.
Right, and when they wiped the EU and started over, Disney said, there's one canon, if we say it from this point forward, anywhere in any format, that is canon.
Done.
Which, who here has seen Solo? And that's all I'll say on that subject. So I'm a big fan of a lot of Star Wars stuff. Sometimes things get too weird. I'll tell a Tempest Feud story, since you like Jeff Grubb. At the end of Tempest Feud, you go to a enemy hut's pleasure-barred starship, which has a holographic projector that makes it look like a mountain, so whenever he lands at some place, he makes it look like a mountain and people can't find him. Jeff's original plan was for the starship to be a mountain that looked like the hut, which he called Mount Hutmore, and just had rockets on it so the whole mountain could get up and fly through space as a hut rock-shaped starship. I was at Wizards of the Coast for 6 months when they put me with Jeff Grubb on this project, and I'm like, oh, Mr. Grubb, I'm a big fan. And he said, call me Jeff. And I'm like, great. He said, you're going to have to dial me back. Well, I'm not sure I can do that, Mr. Grubb. So here's my idea. There's this giant starship, and it looks like a hut, and it flies through space like this. Dial it back a little, Jeff. But even when something goes too far, right, that's a perfect example of that's too far, but I actually think a holographic projector that makes your starship look like a big rock so that you're a smuggler and people can't find you, that's cool. So even the things, sometimes I love something that is a guilty pleasure that I think is stupid. I don't think that, like, the crystal spheres from Starjammer would make sense in Starfinder? Spelljammer? Starfinder? I'm sorry. What we're doing is I'm averaging 5 hours of sleep a night that's late on Sunday. But I think it would be great if we did a solar system where, like, their local equivalent of Nex or something built crystal spheres to protect that solar system. And that would be a case where we can take this idea that doesn't match as is and twist it until it's a good match for us.
One of my favorite worlds from a property that is not ours is Zendikar. Mm. Which I guess you could make a planet out of it by making it have shards of land orbiting around the center or something, but it's all islands of shards of, like, the planet broke apart, but it's somehow still stuck together and it still has life all the way down and stuff like that. So, and people have to, they have to jump from world to world and stuff like that. But I also liked Ravnica, which is just a huge city, but it's very diverse. It's not like what's the city in Star Wars?
Coruscant.
It's not like Coruscant. So.
Which itself is just a ripoff of Earth/Terminus from the Foundation series.
And the reason I like Ravnica is just because it despite having one character overarching it, it has a very diverse character inside of it with all these different factions that operate against each other and have different goals, different technologies, different types of magic. So I think that both of those worlds are pretty interesting.
When Monte Cook was working on Planescape, he presented a giant petrified dead god floating through the astral plane, and things lived on it. We've got gods, we've got space, we've killed one god, so we know what happens. I think somewhere between that and Nowhere, the space station that is the inside of a giant celestial's head in Guardians of the Galaxy, that is a rich territory for us to do something with, although we haven't yet.
I'm going to bounce back a little bit to a topic we were touching on before. We're drawing from real world inspiration. How much time and, like, effort do you spend sort of keeping track of, like, what we're finding about in our own universe right now? Cause, like, we are being able to really see and measure and identify a lot of stuff out there that we've never been able to really grapple before. Do you stay on top of sort of, like, current astronomical news at all or not? And if you do, how?
There are several geek-themed media sites, IO9 and Kotaku, and there's another one I could come up with if it weren't Sunday, that is actually not part of the same network. I usually spend a few minutes every day looking at the headlines of their new articles, because when they, for example, you know, they found the God particle, that is headlined as geek news, and that helps me keep up with that circle of stuff. And I think, and while I do like Gawker Media and their coverage of geek-related things. I think it's good to have a range of different sites. And I've sort of trained my Facebook to show me the cool stuff posted from my friends who are into that kind of geek science. So it actually becomes useful, although, again, with Facebook, you want to drill down to a primary source. If you actually care about what's current, if you just want to be inspired, then again, lying, click-based gobbledygook can be just as inspirational as anything else. So I do it a few minutes a day, basically, and that helps me stay informed.
I don't do it regularly, but I do subscribe to, like, Quora and and the questions that are asked there and related to science and astrophysics, space. And
a lot of alternate history World War II stuff.
Yeah, and then Medium also has ways that you can get that type of information.
Mm-hmm.
And I just pay attention to what my friends are talking about, too. Like, you know, that's where I found out about the thrusters that NASA's working on that actually work in space but don't provide thrusters. They don't eject something to provide
the thrusters. They appear to be functional reactionless drives.
Yeah.
Which, if that works, changes everything. And we know that they work in a vacuum, so it's not a heat process, and they are going to release one in space, turn it on, and see if it drifts away or not.
It's one of those things that somehow they don't really understand completely how it works. Like, it shouldn't work, but it does.
And the amount of thrust it performs is so minute that it could be a rounding error on the vibration of the Earth affecting your impact scale. So there's still debates, even though every time people test it, it passes the test. There are still people that are convinced that we are not thinking of something that causes those to be a false positive. Like, for a while, CERN was saying, we have found a particle that's traveling faster than the speed of light, and that absolutely should not be the case. And it turns out there was a cable loose. That is literally what happened. There was a cable loose, and when they found it and wiggled it back into place, things were no longer traveling faster than the speed of light.
Fixed it!
We broke the universe.
That's the great thing about science, right? If you make an extraordinary claim, you need extraordinary proof. So at first, everyone was going, that's clearly stupid. And then one person tried it, and they're like, no, it works. The ultimate test will be, and there are now people getting the money to do it, we're going to put one in space, turn it on. Either it flies away or it doesn't. If it does, that's kind of definitive.
What up?
Yeah, that reminds me of a story I heard about the discovery of cosmic background radiation, which was back in the Cold War era.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The cosmological constant, which we have discovered and we use in all sorts of calculations. Einstein originally could not get some of his formulas to work unless he threw in a number, which he could not justify why it was there. But the number he threw in turns out to be the cosmological constant. So mathematically, he discovered it and just said, well, this is clearly some sort of rounding error, but it works this way. And later we figured out, yes, there is actually a thing there.
Math.
Yes. I just like to point out, many of my friends are astronomers, and fully half of them in the last 10 years are no longer astronomers because the jobs aren't out there.
Yeah.
So anything anyone can do to support astronomy, the sciences, etc., many of them are no longer working in the field.
And if you don't support it, we'll stop having cool ideas and you can't play your game. So, yes, actually, do that.
Motivation.
Totally.
Yes, if space gets defunded, what are we going to use for navigation?
This might be outside the scope of this design panel, but I guess we touched on it a little bit. What do you do for inspirations for societies and the like on these planets?
That's a good question. I mean, it's a peaceful planet.
Sometimes it's based on what the planet, or whatever the inspiration for the planet is, right? She added a ooze creature inspiration that naturally followed to create mobile ooze cities. That naturally tells you something about, you know, if they're mobile ooze cities, we're probably talking about some sort of city-state, etc. So frequently it's a matter of charting what we have already said and seeing where that logically causes us to progress or where we get into another piece of inspiration. Chris?
Well, often the world will demand a certain type of society. Like, there's a species in one of the upcoming APs that they are the way they are because they have to cooperate to survive on the planet, basically. And they're good engineers because they have to be good at engineering because the planet doesn't cooperate with them. So they have to build things that are resilient, and when the planet is moving around, they'll just get crushed. And they have long, flexible bodies because they also have to move in these warrens and tunnels and be able to get out of tight spaces that suddenly appear and stuff like that. So I think that a planet can demand a certain type of society. I mean, I think that you can look at that even on Earth, where competition over resources has created certain types of societies and stuff like that.
Go ahead, and then I've got another question I'm going to throw in the stack here.
How similar or different do you tend to think that a planet or a species has to be from Earth for it to be interesting, but also believable and relatable?
One of my favorite science fiction series, although it has a few major problems that as being written in the 30s, and I acknowledge them, but one of my favorite science fiction series is the Lensman series. One of the things I love about the Lensman series is that one of the very early books, our main character goes out to talk to someone who is sufficiently psychic that he might be able to help with an upcoming war on Pluto. And the creature that lives on Pluto is a fifth or sixth dimensional creature. Only part of it is visible in three or four dimensions. It is from a society where cowardice is considered the only possible virtue. If you are not a coward, then you are horrifically and insanely risking yourself. And this creature won't get within 30 feet of our hero because our hero is made of liquid water. Because it's on a planet where everything is hundreds of degrees below zero. So to it, it's like talking to a creature made of liquid magma. If it coughs, the water droplets will sear right through it. And it is performing an activity called Dexel Drooping. And our hero is like, what is that? It says Dexel Drooping. Don't you Dexel Droop? I'm using a universal translator. I understand everything you're saying except Dexel Drooping. Why don't I know what that is? Well, here, I will show you. And then it jiggles a few times, spins a few times, changes shapes, and says, I have Dexel Droop. You have observed and understand? I see that you do not understand. Well, I guess too much of Dexel Drooping involves the fifth and sixth dimension. You're literally incapable of understanding the activity. I find that character fascinating. And a character of the same race, Nadric, is one of the four great heroes of a later novel. And he talks about how he is insanely non-cowardly, despite the fact that he is the most cautious and cowardly person in the whole series. And when we see his section of the adventure, it is a chapter of him plotting to make sure nothing can go wrong with his plan, nothing can go wrong with his plan, nothing can go wrong with his plan. All right, there's a 1 in 10 million chance this won't go right. I should keep working on this a few years, but time is urgent. He presses a button, and everything happens just the way he planned. And he goes, phew, that was a huge risk. That is a totally alien, incomprehensible creature, and I love him to death. So as long as there's, again, Chris was talking about a hook, as long as there's an interesting hook, speaking of cowardice, in Ringworld, there are Pearson's puppeteers. Pearson's puppeteers are cowardly. Their leader is known as the Hindmost because he leads the fleet from as far in the back as possible. Their brain is in the center of their bodies, and their heads have manipulatable lips that they can expend, but they don't want to because it's like getting a finger cut off. They're cowards and have a vast profitable empire. When you take something like that, you say, here's a hook, here's some interesting stuff, absolutely alien to humans, as long as you make that absolutely alien to humans somehow something that the player and GM can interact with, I think it's great.
I also think that the reverse can be true. Like, you can take something that exists on Earth and say, what if this creature was sentient and intelligent? What would that be like? Like,
bears.
Sea anemones.
Yeah.
Sure. Oh, yeah.
You know, what if a sea anemone was intelligent and it had a society and they knew about space travel and could do it? What would they be like?
Or to go a different direction, what if viruses were sent to you? They only exist they have to make someone sick to procreate, they don't live that long, but if they were sentient, you could have a society evolving inside you. And then if it got advanced enough, it might try and communicate with you. It might think you're God. those are all things. We can take this thing that we have on Earth, viruses, and say, hey, if they started thinking... And then, of course, if it's intestinal worms, instead you're doing a Futurama episode. But the same... The same idea can be taken.
So I'm going to jump in with a question here because it's kind of touched on a thing both of you have said now. All of the planets I have seen in that we've touched on in Starfinder have interact with the larger galaxy in some way. They mm-hmm. either have achieved space travel or space travel has come to them.
Right.
Do you ever feel like you hit a rut with how that happens? Like, oh, here's yet another society that has recently been contacted by explorers from the Pact Worlds. And what do you do to combat that?
In the Pact Worlds in particular, we have this mechanism that when Triune gave the technology for the drift to the universe, she gave it randomly to a whole bunch of species, and no one knows why she picked some and not others. So everyone in the Pact Worlds got it. The Vesk didn't. So they were stuck until they contacted someone and they had to steal the drive. James Sutter, who used to be the creative director, and Rob and I were talking about the fact we could see a Stone Age culture where a shaman wakes up with this dream, gets some crushed berries, and draws out the design for a drift engine. Stands back and says, "The gods have told me of this. I have no idea what it is. But I do see that this requires technology we don't have, so I'm going to recommend that we investigate this thing called fire." So we have this mechanism where societies can all be pushed towards the same technology. And also, we've only been out for a year, so I don't feel like I'm in a rut yet. I suppose it could happen. But even with dozens of worlds, right, it's not hard to think of a dozen different ways to do things.
I don't know. I just see it as more possibilities. It doesn't really feel limiting to me that space travel has to be involved, because it's an exploration game. But I guess that is an outgrowth of also not feeling like I'm in a rut because I'm so new to working on this project. So it's hard to answer. It's actually hard to imagine falling into a rut with so many possibilities that you can just, you know, you could like pull three different random books off the shelf and say, okay, this is what I'm going to base my plan on. I'm going to read page 35 of this book, and I'm going to read page 48 of this book, and I'm going to read page 97 of this book, and I'm just going to make the plan
well. Yeah, I guess really specifically though, what I'm going for is like, so you've got your planet, and then you've got the space flight element, and sort of that piece. I feel like I am in a rut with that. I have a lot of trouble coming up with ways that to integrate space flight into all these different cultures that don't come back to like the same two or three reasons.
I guess it's just a problem. I have to admit that I haven't thought over running into that much.
Great. I mean, that's why these guys are doing this, and I just added the words.
When you look, for example, when you look at things like why were various islands and continents in our world discovered, right? We want to find a faster trade route. Well, with the drift, you could obviously be exploring a faster trade route. We want to trade with these people. We want to attack these people. We want to spread our religion to these people. There was pure love of exploration. You know what? I don't know what's on that star. And even with evolving technology, right, the only reason for months or years, people in Europe thought someone in Europe had flown first because word that the Wright brothers had done it days before had not reached them. That's the same basic technology being developed by two people on two continents at a time which communication did not travel much. And that's all ignoring the fact that we say in this book that the Aslanti Star Empire was settled thousands of years ago by people from Aslant who used magic to get there. We still have astral travel. We still have plane of shadow travel. I think we say that Iomedeans sometimes have an astral drive for their cathedral ships, which are different. So we, instead of the real world where there's no technology that really lets you get from world to world yet, we've got dozens of magic and technologies. I just haven't run into it. I just want to say, he said page 35 and page 48. I have two books here, and I am looking at The Chamber of Undeath and a hacker. And I immediately think of a planet where people get computer plants implanted in their heads, kill themselves, learn things while they're dead, and are then brought back to life so that the memories of the things that they learned while they were traveling through the great beyond in the river of souls to Pharasma as information, and that's how they discovered other species exist. I was killed. There was this great river. There was this weird lizard next to me. He said he was a Vesk from another planet. No one expected me to come back. When you jolted me up, I'm like, oh, there's all sorts of stuff out there, and we should go see them. And suddenly we have a new way to communicate. I was just curious what would happen if I used the numbers.
It usually has good results.
Yeah, Death Hacker, I think, is something that I'm not going to forget.
I guess something that ties into your other idea, you could have someone, you know, on planet just become a star shaman without having a space drive.
Yeah, totally.
And then just, let's go visit other planets now. I got a dream. Poof, we're there.
Well, here's the best way. If you're a star shaman and you don't have your people don't have a star drive, your first level ability requires you to get into space or it doesn't do anything. I want to float through space, damn it. Get me there. Build a tower and a slingshot, something.
We also have species that can fly through space without a spaceship, like the Vigo.
Yeah, totally. That's a good point. Yeah, for that matter, we've got the outer dragons who can just...
No, I'll take it. We've got time for one very quick question, then we'll wrap it up.
Yeah, mine wasn't really a question, so you can ask someone else.
Question?
I was
Oh, I was going to say, are there any particular plants you've designed that we have so far you're particularly proud of, or
oh,
that you really have ownership of, that you love?
I can't answer that question because I don't think I've actually designed a planet.
Or a plant that you've already designed and that you've added something to.
I mean, I like the resort that I designed for the Signal and Screams Adventure Path.
But I can't tell you about it, but it is really cool.
That's really cool, yeah.
Yep.
I am a big fan of EOX, which I've done most of the design work on, built on direction from our creative directors, both of them. I am a big fan of my work on Octurn, because in Pathfinder, you cannot tell stories about the Drow because no one knows about them. So one of the whole things we wanted to do was, in Starfinder, have everyone know where they are, and they've got a place, and they've got an economy. And honestly, I really like my little dark shadow world with Black Emerald, just because I think Black Emerald sounds cool. That was literally where that came from originally.
I've done a lot of work in Leovara and Rathita, so I'm like
yeah.
a gas giant person over here.
But also, I'm desperately hoping at some point we put cloud giants on gas giants at some point.
Sure, why not? It seems like a great connection. So we'll go ahead and call it. Thank you all for being here and participating in the planets, and have a great evening.
Thank you very much. And thank you very much to Liz Liddell for moderating. I think you did a good job, and I think another round of applause is called for.
Thank you for joining us for another PaizoCon 2018 seminar recording. Special thanks to the KD Con team, including Justin Sluder, Ryan Hiller, Stephen Glicker, and the entire Roll for Combat crew. No Direction's PaizoCon coverage would not be possible without their tireless effort. Find this and other great Pathfinder podcasts. Visit nodirectionpodcast.com.